even if we manage ourselves well, prosperity holds no guarantees. The world conspires against us in many ways, and the laws of nature say that everything regresses toward the mean. In sports, the schedule gets harder after a winning season, the bad teams get better draft picks, and the salary cap makes it tough to keep a team together. In life, taxes go up the more you make, the more obligations society foists on you. The media is harder on those it has covered before. Rumors and gossip are the cost of renown. He's a drunk, she's gay, he's a hypocrite, she's a bitch. The crowd roots for the underdog and roots against the winners. These are just the facts of life. Who can afford to add denial to all that? Instead of letting power make us delusional, and instead of taking what we have for granted, we'd be better to spend our time preparing for the shifts of fate that inevitably occur in life. That is, adversity, difficulty, failure. Who knows? Maybe a downturn is exactly what's coming next. Worse, maybe you caused it. Just because you did something once doesn't mean you'll be able to do it successfully forever. Reversals and regressions are as much a part of the cycle of life as anything else. But we can manage that, too. Part 3. Failure. Here we are experiencing the trials endemic to any journey. Perhaps we've failed. Perhaps our goal turned out to be harder to achieve than anticipated. No one is permanently successful, and not everyone finds success on the first attempt. We all deal with setbacks along the way. Ego not only leaves us unprepared for these circumstances, it often contributed to their occurrence in the first place. The way through, the way to rise again, requires a reorientation and increased self-awareness. We don't need pity, our own or anyone else's. We need purpose, poise, and patience. To whatever failure and challenges you will face, ego is the enemy. It is because mankind are disposed to sympathize more entirely with our joy than with our sorrow that we make parade of our riches and conceal our poverty. Nothing is so mortifying as to be obliged to expose our distress to the view of the public, and to feel that though our situation is open to the eyes of all mankind, no mortal conceives for us the half of what we suffer. Adam Smith. For the first half of her life, Katharine Graham saw pretty much everything go right. Her father, Eugene Meyer, was a financial genius who made a fortune in the stock market. Her mother was a beautiful as well as brilliant socialite. As a child, Katharine had the best of everything, the best schools, the best teachers, big houses, and servants to wait on her. In 1933, her father bought the Washington Post, then a struggling but important newspaper, which he began to turn around. The only child to express any serious interest in it, Katharine inherited the paper when she was older and handed over the management to her equally impressive husband, Philip Graham. She was not another Howard Hughes who squandered her family's fortune. She was not another rich kid who took the easy road in life because she could. But it was a cushy life, no question about it. She had been, in her words, content to be the tail of her husband's and parents' kite. Then life took a turn. Phil Graham's behavior became increasingly erratic. He drank heavily. He made reckless business decisions and bought things they couldn't afford. He began having affairs. He publicly humiliated his wife in front of nearly everyone they knew. Rich people problems, right? It turns out that he had suffered a severe mental breakdown, and as Katharine attempted to nurse him back to health, he killed himself with a hunting rifle while she napped in the next room. In 1963, at 46 years old, Katharine Graham, a mother of three with no work experience, found herself in charge of the Washington Post Company, a vast corporation with thousands of employees. She was unprepared, timid, and naive. Though tragic, these events were not exactly a cataclysmic failure. Graham was still rich, still white, still privileged. Still, it was not what she thought her life had planned for her. That's the point. Failure and adversity are relative and unique to each of us. Almost without exception, this is what life does. It takes our plans and dashes them to pieces. Sometimes once, sometimes lots of times. As the financial philosopher and economist George Goodman once observed, it is as if we are at a wonderful ball where the champagne sparkles in every glass and soft laughter falls upon the summer air. We know that at some moment the black horseman will come shattering through the terrace doors, wreaking vengeance and scattering the survivors. Those who leave early are saved, but the ball is so splendid no one wants to leave while there is still time. So everybody keeps asking, what time is it? But none of the clocks have hands. He was speaking of economic crises, although he may as well have been talking about where all of us find ourselves, not just once in our lifetimes, but often. Things are going well. Perhaps we're aspiring to some big goal. Perhaps we're finally enjoying the fruits of our labors. At any point, fate can intervene. If success is ego intoxication, then failure can be a devastating ego blow, turning slips into falls and little troubles into great unravelings. But if ego is just a nasty side effect of great success, it can be fatal during failure. We have many names for these problems: sabotage, unfairness, adversity, trials, tragedy. No matter the label, it's a trial. We don't like it, and some of us are sunk by it. Others seem to be built to make it through. In either case, it's a trial each person must endure. This fate is as much written for us as it was written 5,000 years ago for the young king in Gilgamesh. He will face a battle he knows not. He will ride a road he knows not. That's what came to Catherine Graham. It turned out that taking over the paper was the first in a series of trying and wrenching events that lasted for nearly two decades. Thomas Paine, remarking about George Washington, once wrote that there is a natural firmness in some minds which cannot be unlocked by trifles, but which, when unlocked, discovers a cabinet of fortitude. Graham seems to have possessed a similar cabinet. As she settled into her leadership position, Graham found that the paper's conservative board was a constant obstacle. They were patronizing and risk-averse and had held the company back. To succeed, she would have to develop her own compass and not defer to others the way she always had. It eventually became clear that she needed a new executive editor. Against the board's advice, she replaced the well-liked good old boy with an unknown young upstart. Simple enough. The next turn of the screw wasn't. Just as the company was filing to go public, the Post received a collection of stolen government documents that editors asked Graham if they could run, despite a court order preventing their publication. She consulted the company's lawyers. She consulted the board. All advised against it, fearing it could sink the IPO or tie the company up in lawsuits for years. Torn, she decided to proceed and publish them, a decision with essentially no precedent. Shortly thereafter, the paper's investigation of a burglary at the Democratic National Committee's headquarters, relying on an anonymous source, threatened to put the company permanently at odds with the White House and Washington's powerful elite, as well as jeopardizing the government licenses they needed for the TV stations the Post owned. At one point, Nixon loyalist and the Attorney General of the United States, John Mitchell, threatened that Graham had so overreached that her tit was going to be caught in a big fat ringer. Another aide bragged that the White House was now thinking about how to screw the paper over. Put yourself in her shoes, the most powerful office in the world explicitly strategizing, how can we hurt the Post the most? On top of that, the Post's stock price was less than stellar. The market was poor. In 1974, an investor began aggressively buying up shares in the company. The board was terrified. Could mean a hostile takeover. Graham was dispatched to deal with him. The following year, the paper's printers' union began a vicious, protracted strike. At one point, union members wore shirts that said, "Phil shot the wrong Graham." Despite or perhaps because of these tactics, she decided to fight the strike. They fought back. At 4 o'clock one morning came a frantic call. The union had sabotaged company machinery, beaten up an innocent staffer, and then set one of the printing presses on fire. Typically during printing strikes, competitors will help fellow papers out with their printing. But Graham's competitors refused, costing the Post $300,000 a day in advertising revenue. Then a suite of major investors began to sell their stock positions in the Washington Post Company, ostensibly having lost their faith in its prospects. Graham, pushed by the activist investor she'd met with earlier, decided her best option was to spend an enormous amount of the company's money to buy back its own shares on the public markets, a dangerous move that almost no one was doing at the time. That's a list of exhausting problems to hear about, let alone live through. Yet because of Graham's perseverance, it shook out better than anyone could have possibly predicted. The leaked documents that Graham published became known as the Pentagon Papers and were one of the most important stories in the history of journalism. The paper's Watergate reporting, which so incensed the Nixon White House, changed American history and took down an entire administration. It also won the paper a Pulitzer Prize. The investor others had feared turned out to be a young Warren Buffett, who became her business mentor and an enormous advocate and steward of the company. His small investments in her family's company would one day become worth hundreds of millions of dollars. She prevailed in negotiations with the union, and the strike eventually ended. Her main competitor in Washington, the one that had refused to come to her aid, the Star, suddenly folded and was acquired by the Post. Her stock buybacks, made contrary not only to business wisdom, but the judgment of the market, made the company billions of dollars. It turns out that the long, hard slog she endured, the mistakes she made, the repeated failures, crises, and attacks were all leading somewhere. If you'd invested $1 in the Post IPO in 1971, it would be worth $89 by the time Graham stepped down in 1993, compared to $14 for her industry and $5 for the S&P 500. It makes her not just one of the most successful female CEOs of her generation, and the first to run a Fortune 500 company, but one of the best CEOs ever, period. For someone born with a silver spoon in her mouth, the first decade and a half was what you'd call a baptism of fire. Graham faced difficulty after difficulty, difficulties that she wasn't really equipped to handle, or so it seemed. There were times when it probably felt like she should have just sold the damn thing and enjoyed her massive wealth. Graham didn't cause her husband's suicide, but it was left to her to carry on without him. She didn't ask for Watergate and the Pentagon Papers, but it fell on her to navigate their incendiary nature. While others went on buying and merger sprees in the 80s, she didn't. She doubled down on herself and her own company, despite the fact that it was treated as a weakling by Wall Street. She could have taken the easy way 100 times, but did not. At any given moment, there is a chance of failure or setbacks. Bill Walsh says almost always, your road to victory goes through a place called failure. In order to taste success again, we've got to understand what led to this moment, or these years, of difficulty. What went wrong, and why? We must deal with the situation in order to move past it. We'll need to accept it and push through it. Graham was alone in most of this. She was blindly feeling her way through the dark, trying to figure out a tough situation she never expected to be in. She's an example of how you can do almost everything right and still find yourself in deep shit. We think that failure only comes to egomaniacs who are begging for it. Nixon deserved to fail, did Graham? The reality is that while yes, often people set themselves up to crash, good people fail, or other people fail them, all the time too. People who have already been through a lot find themselves stuck with more. Life isn't fair. Ego loves this notion, the idea that something is fair or not. Psychologists call it narcissistic injury when we take personally totally indifferent and objective events. We do that when our sense of self is fragile and dependent on life going our way all the time. Whether what you're going through is your fault or your problem doesn't matter, because it's yours to deal with right now. Graham's ego didn't cause her to fail, but if she'd had one, it certainly would have prevented her from succeeding ever again. You could say that failure always arrives uninvited, but through our ego, far too many of us allow it to stick around. What did Graham need through all this? Not swagger, not bluster. She needed to be strong. She needed confidence and a willingness to endure. A sense of right and wrong. Purpose. It wasn't about her. It was about preserving her family's legacy, protecting the paper, doing her job. What about you? Will your ego betray you when things get difficult? Or can you proceed without it? When we face difficulty, particularly public difficulty, doubters, scandals, losses, our friend the ego will show its true colors. Absorbing the negative feedback, ego says, "I knew you couldn't do it. Why did you ever try?" It claims, "This isn't worth it. This isn't fair. This is somebody else's problem. Why don't you come up with a good excuse and wash your hands of this?" It tells us we shouldn't have to put up with this. It tells us that we're not the problem. That is, it adds self-injury to every injury you experience. To paraphrase Epicurus, the narcissistically inclined live in an unwalled city. A fragile sense of self is constantly under threat. Illusions and accomplishments are not defenses. Not when you've got the special, sensitive antennae trained to receive and create the signals that challenge your precarious balancing act. It is a miserable way to live. The year before Walsh took over the 49ers, they went 2-14. His first year as head coach and general manager, they went 2-14. Can you imagine the disappointment? All the changes, all the work that went into that first year, and to end up in the exact same spot as the incompetent coach who preceded you? That's how most of us would think. And then we'd probably start blaming other people. Walsh said he realized he had to look for evidence elsewhere that it was turning around. For him, it was in how the games were being played, the good decisions, and the changes that were being made inside the organization. Two seasons later, they won the Super Bowl, and then several more after that. At rock bottom, those victories must have felt like a long way off, which is why you have to be able to see past and through. As Gercher once observed, the great failing is to see yourself as more than you are and to value yourself at less than your true worth. A good metaphor might be the kind of stock buybacks that Katharine Graham made in the late 70s and 80s. Stock buybacks are controversial. They usually come from a company that is stalled or whose growth is decelerating. With buybacks, a CEO is making a rather incredible statement. She's saying, the market is wrong. It's valuing our company so incorrectly and clearly has so little idea where we are heading that we're going to spend the company's precious cash on a bet that they're wrong. Too often, dishonest or egotistical CEOs buy back company stock because they're delusional or because they want to artificially inflate the stock price. Conversely, timid or weak CEOs wouldn't even consider betting on themselves. In Graham's case, she made a value judgment. With Buffett's help, she could see objectively that the market didn't appreciate the true worth of the company's assets. She knew that the reputational hits, the learning curve, had all contributed to a suppressed stock price, which aside from reducing her personal wealth, created a massive opportunity for the company. Over a short period, she would buy nearly 40% of the company's shares at a fraction of what they'd later be worth. The stock that Katharine Graham bought for approximately $20 a share would less than a decade later be worth more than $300. What both Graham and Walsh were doing was adhering to a set of internal metrics that allowed them to evaluate and gauge their progress while everyone on the outside was too distracted by the supposed signs of failure or weakness. This is what guides us through difficulty. You might not get into your first choice college. You might not get picked for the project, or you might get passed over for the promotion. Someone might outbid you for the job, for your dream house, for the opportunity you feel everything depends on. This might happen tomorrow. It might happen 25 years from now. It could last for 2 minutes or 10 years. We know that everyone experiences failure and adversity, that we're all subject to the rules of gravity and averages. What does that mean? It means we'll face them too. As Plutarch finally expressed, the future bears down upon each one of us with all the hazards of the unknown. The only way out is through. Humble and strong people don't have the same trouble with these troubles that egotists do. There are fewer complaints and far less self-immolation. Instead, there's a stoic, even cheerful resilience. Pity isn't necessary. Their identity isn't threatened. They can get by without constant validation. This is what we're aspiring to, much more than mere success. What matters is that we can respond to what life throws at us and how we make it through. Alive time or dead time? Live without wasted time. The words of a Parisian political slogan. Malcolm X was a criminal. He wasn't Malcolm X at the time. They called him Detroit Red, and he was a criminal opportunist who did a little bit of everything. He ran numbers, he sold drugs, he worked as a pimp, then he moved up to armed robbery. He had his own burglary gang, which he ruled over with a combination of intimidation and boldness, exploiting the fact that he did not seem afraid to kill or die. Then finally he was arrested for trying to fence an expensive watch he'd stolen. He was carrying a gun at the time, though to his credit he made no move to fight the officers who had trapped him. In his apartment they found jewelry, furs, an arsenal of guns, and all his burglary tools. He got 10 years. It was February 1946. He was barely 21 years old. Even accounting for the shameful American racism and whatever systemic legal injustices existed at the time, Malcolm X was guilty. He deserved to go to jail. Who knows who else he would have hurt or killed had he continued his escalating life of crime? When your actions land you a lengthy prison sentence, rightly tried and convicted, something has gone wrong. You've failed not only yourself, but the basic standards of society and morality. That was the case with Malcolm. So there he was in prison, a number, a body with roughly a decade to sit in a cage. He faced what Robert Greene, a man who 60 years later would find his wildly popular books banned in many federal prisons, calls an alive time or dead time scenario. How would the 7 years ultimately play out? What would Malcolm do with his time? According to Greene, there are two types of time in our lives. Dead time, when people are passive and waiting, and alive time, when people are learning, acting, and utilizing every second. Every moment of failure, every moment or situation that we did not deliberately choose or control presents this choice. Alive time, dead time. Which will it be? Malcolm chose alive time. He began to learn. He explored religion. He taught himself to be a reader by checking out a pencil in the dictionary from the prison library, and not only consumed it from start to finish, but copied it down longhand from cover to cover. All these words he'd never known existed before were transferred to his brain. As he said later, from then until I left that prison, in every free moment I had, if I was not reading in the library, I was reading in my bunk. He read history, he read sociology, he read about religion, he read the classics, he read philosophers like Kant and Spinoza. Later, a reporter asked Malcolm, "What's your alma mater?" His one-word answer, books. Prison was his college. He transcended confinement through the pages he absorbed. He reflected that months passed without his even thinking about being detained against his will. He had, as he said, never been so truly free in his life. Most people know what Malcolm X did after he got out of prison, but they don't realize or understand how prison made that possible. How a mix of acceptance, humility, and strength powered the transformation. They also aren't aware of how common this is in history, How many figures took seemingly terrible situations, a prison sentence, an exile, a bear market or depression, military conscription, even being sent to a concentration camp, and through their attitude and approach, turned those circumstances into fuel for their unique greatness? Francis Scott Key wrote the poem that became the national anthem of the United States while trapped on a ship during a prisoner exchange of the War of 1812. Viktor Frankl refined his psychologies of meaning and suffering during his ordeal in 3 Nazi concentration camps. Not that these opportunities always come in such serious situations. The author Ian Fleming was on bed rest and, per doctor's orders, forbidden from using a typewriter. They were worried he'd exert himself by writing another Bond novel, so he created Chitty Chitty Bang Bang by hand instead. Walt Disney made his decision to become a cartoonist while laid up after stepping on a rusty nail. Yes, it would feel better in the moment to be angry, to be aggrieved, to be depressed or heartbroken. When injustice or the capriciousness of fate are inflicted on someone, the normal reaction is to yell, to fight back, to resist. You know the feeling. I don't want this. I want blank. I want it my way. This is short-sighted. Think of what you've been putting off, issues you've declined to deal with, systemic problems that felt too overwhelming to address. Dead time is revived when we use it as an opportunity to do what we've long needed to do. As they say, this moment is not your life, but it is a moment in your life. How will you use it? Malcolm could have doubled down on the life that brought him to prison. Dead time isn't only dead because of sloth or complacency. He could have spent those years becoming a better criminal, strengthening his contacts, or planning his next score. But it still would have been dead time. He might have felt alive while doing it, even as he was slowly killing himself. As Robert Greene put it, many a serious thinker has been produced in prisons, where we have nothing to do but think. Yet sadly, prisons in their literal and figurative forms have produced far more degenerates, losers, and ne'er-do-wells. Inmates might have had nothing to do but think, it's just that what they chose to think about made them worse and not better. That's what so many of us do when we fail or get ourselves in trouble. Lacking the ability to examine ourselves, we reinvest our energy into exactly the patterns of behavior that caused our problems to begin with. It comes in many forms. Idly dreaming about the future, plotting our revenge, finding refuge in distraction, refusing to consider that our choices are a reflection of our character. We'd rather do basically anything else. But what if we said, "This is an opportunity for me. I am using it for my purposes. I will not let this be dead time for me." The dead time was when we were controlled by ego. Now we can live. Who knows what you're currently doing? Hopefully it's not a prison term, even if it might feel like it. Maybe you're sitting in remedial high school class. Maybe you're on hold. Maybe it's a trial separation. Maybe you're making smoothies while you save up money. Maybe you're stuck waiting out a contract or a tour of duty. Perhaps this situation is totally one of your own making, or perhaps it's just bad luck. In life, we all get stuck with dead time. Its occurrence isn't in our control. Its use, on the other hand, is. As Booker T. Washington famously put it, cast down your bucket where you are. Make use of what's around you. Don't let stubbornness make a bad situation worse. The effort is enough. What matters to an active man is to do the right thing. Whether the right thing comes to pass should not bother him. Goethe. Belisarius is one of the greatest yet unknown military generals in all of history. His name has been so obscured and forgotten by history that he makes the underappreciated General Marshall seem positively famous. At least they named the Marshall Plan after George. As Rome's highest-ranking commander under the Byzantine Emperor Justinian, Belisarius saved Western civilization on at least 3 occasions. As Rome collapsed and the seat of the empire moved to Constantinople, Belisarius was the only bright light in a dark time for Christianity. He won brilliant victories at Deira, Carthage, Naples, Sicily, and Constantinople. With just a handful of bodyguards against a crowd of tens of thousands, Belisarius saved the throne when an uprising had grown so riotous that the emperor made plans to abdicate. He reclaimed far-flung territories that had been lost for years, despite being undermanned and deprived of resources. He recaptured and defended Rome for the first time since the barbarians had sacked and taken it. All of this before he was 40. His thanks? He was not given public triumphs. Instead, he was repeatedly placed under suspicion by the paranoid emperor he served, Justinian. His victories and sacrifices were undone with foolish treaties and bad faith. His personal historian, Procopius, was corrupted by Justinian to tarnish the man's image and legacy. Later, he was relieved of command. His only remaining title was the deliberately humiliating Commander of the Royal Stable. Oh, and at the end of his illustrious career, Belisarius was stripped of his wealth, and according to the legend, blinded and forced to beg in the streets to survive. Historians, scholars, and artists have lamented and argued about this treatment for centuries. Like all fair-minded people, they're outraged at the stupidity, the ungratefulness, and the injustice that this great and unusual man was subjected to. The one person we don't hear complaining about any of this, not at the time, not at the end of his life, not even in private letters, Belisarius himself. Ironically, he probably could have taken the throne on numerous occasions, though it appears he was never even tempted. While the Emperor Justinian fell prey to all the vices of absolute power, control, paranoia, selfishness, greed, we see hardly a trace of them in Belisarius. In his eyes, he was just doing his job, one he believed was his sacred duty. He knew that he did it well. He knew that what he had done was right. That was enough. In life, there will be times when we do everything right, perhaps even perfectly. Yet the results will somehow be negative. Failure, disrespect, jealousy, even a resounding yawn from the world. Depending on what motivates us, this response can be crushing. If ego holds sway, we'll accept nothing less than full appreciation. A dangerous attitude because when someone works on a project, whether it's a book or a business or otherwise, at a certain point, that thing leaves their hands and enters the realm of the world. It is judged, received, and acted on by other people. It stops being something he controls and depends on them. Belisarius could win his battles. He could lead his men. He could determine his personal ethics. He could not control whether his work was appreciated or whether it aroused suspicion. He had no ability to control whether a powerful dictator would treat him well. This reality rings essentially true for everyone in every kind of life. What was so special about Belisarius was that he accepted the bargain. Doing the right thing was enough. Serving his country, his God, doing his duty faithfully was all that mattered. Any adversity could be endured and any rewards were considered extra. Which is good because not only was he often not rewarded for the good he did, he was punished. That seems galling at first. Indignation is a reaction we'd have if it happened to us or someone we know. What was his alternative? Should he have done the wrong thing instead? We are all faced with this same challenge in the pursuit of our own goals. Will we work hard for something that can be taken away from us? Will we invest time and energy if an outcome is not guaranteed? With the right motives, we're willing to proceed. With ego, we're not. We have only minimal control over the rewards for our work and effort. Other people's validations, recognition, rewards. So what are we going to do? Not be kind, not work hard, not produce because there is a chance it wouldn't be reciprocated? Come on. Think of all the activists who will find that they can only advance their cause so far. The leaders who are assassinated before their work is done. The inventors whose ideas languish ahead of their time. According to society's main metrics, these people were not rewarded for their work. Should they have not done it? Yet an ego every one of us has considered doing precisely that. If that is your attitude, how do you intend to endure tough times? What if you're ahead of the times? What if the market favors some bogus trend? What if your boss or your clients don't understand? It's far better when doing good work is sufficient. In other words, the less attached we are to outcomes, the better. When fulfilling our own standards is what fills us with pride and self-respect. when the effort, not the results, good or bad, is enough. With ego, this is not nearly sufficient. No, we need to be recognized. We need to be compensated. Especially problematic is the fact that often we get that. We are praised. We are paid. We start to assume that the two things always go together. The expectation hangover inevitably ensues. There was an unusual encounter between Alexander the Great and the famous Cynic philosopher Diogenes. Allegedly, Alexander approached Diogenes, who was laying down enjoying the summer air, stood over him, and asked what he, the most powerful man in the world, might be able to do for this notoriously poor man. Diogenes could have asked for anything. What he requested was epic. Stop blocking my sun. Even 2,000 years later, we can feel exactly where in the solar plexus that must have hit Alexander, a man who always wanted to prove how important he was. As the author Robert Louis Stevenson later observed about this meeting, it is a sore thing to have labored along and scaled arduous hilltops, and when all is done, find humanity indifferent to your achievement. Well, get ready for it. It will happen. Maybe your parents will never be impressed. Maybe your girlfriend won't care. Maybe the investor won't see the numbers. Maybe the audience won't clap. But we have to be able to push through. We can't let that be what motivates us. Belisarius had one last run. He was found innocent of the charges and his honors restored, just in time to save the empire as a white-haired old man. Except no, life is not a fairy tale. He was again wrongly suspected of plotting against the emperor. In the famous Longfellow poem about our poor general, at the end of his life, he is impoverished and disabled. Yet he concludes with great strength. This too can bear. I still am Belisarius. You will be unappreciated. You will be sabotaged. You will experience surprising failures. Your expectations will not be met. You will lose. You will fail. How do you carry on then? How do you take pride in yourself and your work? John Wooden's advice to his player says it. Change the definition of success. As he put it, success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction in knowing you made the effort to do your best, to become the best that you are capable of becoming. Ambition, Marcus Aurelius reminded himself, means tying your well-being to what other people say or do. Sanity means tying it to your own actions. Do your work, do it well, then let go and let God. That's all there needs to be. Recognition and rewards, those are just extra. Rejection, that's on them, not on us. John Kennedy Toole's great book, A Confederacy of Dunces, was universally turned down by publishers, news that so broke his heart he later committed suicide in his car on an empty road in Biloxi, Mississippi. After his death, his mother discovered the book, advocated on its behalf until it was published, and it eventually won a Pulitzer Prize. Think about that for a second. What changed between those submissions? Nothing. The book was the same. It was equally great when Toole had it in manuscript form and had fought with editors about it, as it was when the book was published, sold copies, and won awards. If only he could have realized this, it would have saved him so much heartbreak. He couldn't, but from his painful example, we can at least see how arbitrary many of the breaks in life are. This is why we can't let externals determine whether something was worth it or not. It's on us. The world is, after all, indifferent to what we humans want. If we persist in wanting, in needing, we are simply setting ourselves up for resentment or worse. Doing the work is enough. Fight Club Moments. If you shut up truth and bury it under the ground, it will but grow and gather to itself such explosive power that the day it bursts through, it will blow up everything in its way. Emile Zola. There is hardly the space to list all the successful people who have hit rock bottom. The notion everyone experiences jarring, perspective-altering moments is almost a cliché. That doesn't mean it isn't true. J.K. Rowling finds herself 7 years after college with a failed marriage, no job, single parent, kids she can barely feed, and approaching homelessness. A teenage Charlie Parker thinks he's tearing it up on stage, right in the pocket with the rest of the crew, until Joe Jones throws a cymbal at him and chases him away in humiliation. A young Lyndon Johnson is beaten to a pulp by a hill country farm boy over a girl, finally shattering his picture of himself as cock of the walk. There are many ways to hit bottom. Almost everyone does it in their own way, at some point. In the novel Fight Club, the character Jack's apartment is blown up. All of his possessions, every stick of furniture, which he pathetically loved, were lost. Later it turns out that Jack blew it up himself. He had multiple personalities, and Tyler Durden orchestrated the explosion to shock Jack from the sad stupor he was afraid to do anything about. The result was a journey into an entirely different and rather dark part of his life. In Greek mythology, characters often experience katabasis, or a going down. They're forced to retreat, they experience a depression, or in some cases literally descend into the underworld. When they emerge, it's with heightened knowledge and understanding. Today, we'd call that hell, and on occasion, we all spend some time there. We surround ourselves with bullshit, with distractions, with lies about what makes us happy and what's important. We become people we shouldn't become and engage in destructive, awful behaviors. This unhealthy and ego-derived state hardens and becomes almost permanent, until katabasis forces us to face it. Duris dura fragantur. Hard things are broken by hard things. The bigger the ego, the harder the fall. It would be nice if it didn't have to be this way. If we could nicely be nudged to correct our ways. If a quiet admonishment was what it took to shoo away illusions. If we could manage to circumvent ego on our own. But it is just not so. The Reverend William A. Sutton observed some 120 years ago that we cannot be humble except by enduring humiliations. How much better it would be to spare ourselves these experiences, but sometimes it's the only way the blind can be made to see. In fact, many significant life changes come from moments in which we are thoroughly demolished, in which everything we thought we knew about the world is rendered false. We might call these Fight Club moments. Sometimes they are self-inflicted, sometimes inflicted on us. But whatever the cause, they can be catalysts for changes we were petrified to make. Pick a time in your life, or perhaps it's a moment you're experiencing now. A boss's eviscerating critique of you in front of the entire staff. That sit down with the person you loved. The Google alert that delivered the article you'd hoped would never be written. The call from the creditor. The news that threw you back in your chair, speechless and dumbfounded. It was in those moments, when the break exposes something unseen before, that you were forced to make eye contact with a thing called truth. No longer could you hide or pretend. Such a moment raises many questions. How do I make sense of this? How do I move onward and upward? Is this the bottom, or is there more to come? Someone told me my problems, so how do I fix them? How did I let this happen? How can it never happen again? A look at history finds that these events seem to be defined by three traits. One, they almost always came at the hands of some outside force or person. Two, they often involved things we already knew about ourselves but were too scared to admit. Three, from the ruin came the opportunity for great progress and improvement. Does everyone take advantage of that opportunity? Of course not. Ego often causes the crash and then blocks us from improving. Was the 2008 financial crisis not a moment in which everything was laid bare for many people? The lack of accountability, the overleveraged lifestyles, the greed, the dishonesty, the trends that could not possibly continue. For some, this was a wake-up call. Others, just a few years later, are back exactly where they were. For them, it will be worse the next time. Hemingway had his own rock-bottom realizations as a young man. The understanding he took from them is expressed timelessly in his book, A Farewell to Arms. He wrote, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward many are strong at the broken places. But those that will not break, it kills." The world can show you the truth, but no one can force you to accept it. In 12-step groups, almost all the steps are about suppressing the ego and clearing out the entitlements and baggage and wreckage that has been accumulated, so that you might see what's left when all of that is stripped away and the real you is left. It's always so tempting to turn to that old friend, denial, which is your ego refusing to believe that which you don't like could be true. Psychologists often say that threatened egotism is one of the most dangerous forces on earth. The gang member whose honor is impugned, the narcissist who is rejected, the bully who is made to feel shame, the imposter who is exposed, the plagiarist or the embellisher whose story stops adding up. These are not people who you want to be near when they are cornered, nor is it a corner you want to back yourself into. That's where you think, how can these people talk to me this way? Who do they think they are? I'll make them all pay. Sometimes because we can't face what's been said or what's been done, we do the unthinkable in response to the unbearable. We escalate. This is ego in its purest and most toxic form. Look at Lance Armstrong. He cheated, but so did a lot of people. It was when this cheating was made public and he was forced to see, if only for a second, that he was a cheater, that things got really bad. He insisted on denying it despite all the evidence. He insisted on ruining other people's lives. We're so afraid to lose our own esteem, or God forbid the esteem of others, that we contemplate doing terrible things. As the Bible verse goes, everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. Big and small, this is what we do. Getting hit with that spotlight doesn't feel good, whether we're talking about the exposure of ordinary self-deception or true evil. But turning away only delays the reckoning. For how long? No one can say. Face the symptoms, cure the disease. Ego makes it so hard. It's easier to delay, to double down, to deliberately avoid seeing the changes we need to make in our lives. But change begins by hearing the criticism in the words of the people around you. Even if those words are mean-spirited, angry, or hurtful, it means weighing them, discarding the ones that don't matter, and reflecting on the ones that do. In Fight Club, the character has to firebomb his own apartment to finally break through. Our expectations and exaggerations and lack of restraint made such moments inevitable, ensuring that it would be painful. Now it's here. What will you make of it? You can change, or you can deny. Vince Lombardi said this once, a team, like men, must be brought to its knees before it can rise again. So yes, hitting bottom is as brutal as it sounds. But the feeling after is one of the most powerful perspectives in the world. President Obama described it as he neared the end of his tumultuous, trying terms. I've been in the barrel tumbling down Niagara Falls, and I emerged, and I lived, and that's such a liberating feeling. If we could help it would be better if we never suffered illusions at all. It'd be better if we never had to kneel or go over the edge. That's what we spent so much time talking about so far in this book. If that fight is lost, we end up here. In the end, the only way you can appreciate your progress is to stand on the edge of the hole you dug for yourself, look down inside it, and smile fondly at the bloody claw prints that marked your journey up the walls. Draw the line. It can ruin your life only if it ruins your character. Marcus Aurelius. John DeLorean ran his car company into the ground with a mix of outsized ambition, negligence, narcissism, greed, and mismanagement. As the bad news began to pile up and the picture was made clear in public, how do you think he responded? Was it with resigned acceptance? Did he acknowledge the errors his disgruntled employees were speaking out about for the first time? Was he able to reflect even slightly on the mistakes and decisions that had brought him, his investors, and his employees so much trouble? Of course not. Instead, he put into motion a series of events that would end in a $60 million drug deal and his subsequent arrest. That's right. After his company began to fail, failure almost exclusively tied to his unprofessional management style, he figured the best way to save it all would be to secure financing through an illegal shipment of 220 pounds of cocaine. Sure, after his publicized and very embarrassing arrest, DeLorean was eventually acquitted on the charges on the rather implausible argument of entrapment. Except he is on video holding up a baggie of cocaine, saying with giddy excitement, "This stuff is as good as gold." There's no question about who caused John DeLorean's disintegration. There's also no question about who made it so much worse. The answer is him. He found himself in a hole and kept digging until he made it all the way to hell. If only he'd stop. If at any point he'd said, "Is this the person I want to be?" People make mistakes all the time. They start companies they think they can manage. They have grand and bold visions that were a little too grandiose. This is all perfectly fine. It's what being an entrepreneur or a creative or even a business executive is all about. We take risks, we mess up. The problem is when we get our identity tied up in our work, we worry that any kind of failure will then say something bad about us as a person. It's a fear of taking responsibility, of admitting that we might have messed up. It's the sunk cost fallacy, and so we throw good money and good life after bad and end up making everything so much worse. Let's say the walls feel like they're closing in. It might feel as if you've been betrayed or your life's work is being stolen. But these are not rational good emotions that will lead to rational good actions. Ego asks, "Why is this happening to me? How do I save this and prove to everyone I'm as great as they think?" It's the animal fear of even the slightest sign of weakness. You've seen this, you've done this, fighting desperately for something we're only making worse. It is not a path to great things. Take Steve Jobs. He was 100% responsible for his firing from Apple. Due to his later success, Apple's decision to fire him seems like an example of poor leadership, but he was, at the time, unmanageable. His ego was unequivocally out of control. If you were John Sculley and the CEO of Apple, you'd have fired that version of Steve Jobs too, and been right to do so. Now Steve Jobs' response to his firing was understandable. He cried, he fought. When he lost, he sold all but a single share of his stock in Apple and swore never to think of the place again. But then he started a new company and threw his whole life into it. He tried to learn as best he could from the management mistakes at the root of his first failure. He started another company after that too, called Pixar. Steve Jobs, the famous egomaniac who parked in handicapped parking spaces just because he could, responded in this critical moment in a surprisingly humble way. Humble for CEOs convinced of their own genius anyway. He worked until he'd not only proven himself again, but significantly resolved the flaws that had caused his downfall to begin with. It's not often that successful or powerful people are able to do this. Not when they experience heartrending failure. American Apparel's founder, Doug Charney, is an example. After losses of some $300 million and numerous scandals, the company offered him a choice. Step aside as CEO and guide the company as a creative consultant for a large salary, or be fired. He rejected both options and picked something much worse. After filing a lawsuit in protest, he gambled his entire ownership in the company to initiate a hostile takeover with a hedge fund and insisted that his conduct be investigated and judged. It was, and he was not vindicated. His personal life was splashed across the headlines and embarrassing details revealed. The lawyer he chose to represent him in his lawsuits happened to be the same one who'd already sued Charney close to half a dozen times for sexual harassment and financial irregularities. In the past, Charney had accused this man of shaking him down and making bogus legal claims. Now, they were working together. American Apparel spent more than $10 million it didn't have to fight him off. A judge issued a restraining order. Sales slumped. Finally, the company began laying off factory workers and longtime employees, the exact people he claimed to be fighting for, just to stay afloat. A year later, they were bankrupt, and he was out of money too. I was there. I saw all of it. It broke my heart. It's like the disgraced statesman and general Alcibiades. In the Peloponnesian War, he fought first for his home country and greatest love, Athens. Then driven out for a drunken crime he may or may not have committed, he defected to Sparta, Athens' sworn enemy. Then, running afoul of the Spartans, he defected to Persia, the sworn enemy of both. Finally, he was recalled to Athens, where his ambitious plans to invade Sicily drove the Athenians to their ultimate ruin. Ego kills what we love. Sometimes it comes close to killing us, too. It is interesting that Alexander Hamilton, who of all the founding fathers met the most tragic and unnecessary end, would have wise words on this topic. But indeed he does, if only he could have remembered his own advice before fighting his fatal duel. "Act with fortitude and honor," he wrote to a distraught friend in serious financial and legal trouble of the man's own making. "If you cannot reasonably hope for a favorable extrication, do not plunge deeper. Have the courage to make a full stop." A full stop. It's not that these folks should have quit everything. It's that a fighter who can't tap out or a boxer who can't recognize when it's time to retire gets hurt. Seriously so. You have to be able to see the bigger picture. But when ego is in control, who can? Let's say you failed, and let's even say it was your fault. Shit happens, and as they say, sometimes shit happens in public. It's not fun. The questions remain. Are you going to make it worse? Are you going to emerge from this with your dignity and character intact? Are you going to live to fight another day? When a team looks like they're going to lose a game, the coach doesn't call them all over and lie to them. Instead, he or she reminds them who they are and what they're capable of, and urges them to go back out there and embody that. With winning or miracles off their mind, a good team does its best to complete the game at the highest standard possible, and share the playing time with other players who don't regularly play. And sometimes, they even come back and win. Most trouble is temporary, unless you make that not so. Recovery is not grand, it's one step in front of the other, unless your cure is more of the disease. Only ego thinks embarrassment or failure are more than what they are. History is full of people who suffered abject humiliations, yet recovered to have long and impressive careers. Politicians who lost elections or lost offices due to indiscretions, but came back to lead after time had passed. Actors whose movies bombed, authors who got writer's block, celebrities who made gaffes, parents who made mistakes, entrepreneurs with faltering companies, executives who got fired, athletes who were cut, people who lived too well at the top of the market. All of these folks felt the hard edge of failure, just like we have. When we lose, we have a choice. Are we going to make this a lose-lose situation for ourselves and everyone involved? Or will this be a lose and then win? Because you will lose in life. It's a fact. A doctor has to call time of death at some point. They just do. Ego says we're the immovable object, the unstoppable force. This delusion causes the problems. It meets failure and adversity with rule-breaking, betting everything on some crazy scheme, doubling down on behind-the-scenes machinations or unlikely Hail Marys, even though that's what got you to this pain point in the first place. At any given time in the circle of life, we may be aspiring, succeeding, or failing, though right now, we're failing. With wisdom, we understand that these positions are transitory, not statements about your value as a human being. When success begins to slip from your fingers, for whatever reason, the response isn't to grip and claw so hard that you shatter it to pieces. It's to understand that you must work yourself back to the aspirational phase. You must get back to first principles and best practices. "He who fears death will never do anything worthy of a living man," Seneca once said. Alter that. He who will do anything to avoid failure will almost certainly do something worthy of failure. The only real failure is abandoning your principles. Killing what you love because you can't bear to part from it is selfish and stupid. If your reputation can't absorb a few blows, it wasn't worth anything in the first place. Maintain your own scorecard. I never look back, except to find out about mistakes. I only see danger in thinking back about things you are proud of. Elizabeth Noel Neumann. On April 16th, 2000, the New England Patriots drafted an extra quarterback out of the University of Michigan. They'd scouted him thoroughly and had their eye on him for some time. Seeing that he was still available, they took him. It was the